Hi, I'm Renee.
And I'm Anthony. We are the voices and founders of Blue Soul Earth, where we teach and we lead workshops and retreats about heart-centered living and unity consciousness.
Welcome to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. We combine esoteric wisdom and the experiences that people have had for millennia and beyond with the latest breakthroughs in science, health, cosmology, physics, and the arts.
In each episode, you'll tune into cutting-edge visionaries who are making a powerful dent in consciousness from different industries and cultures around the world.
Our interviews cross boundaries and at times break conventional thinking as we redefine what reality is, what spirituality means, and what consciousness does.
Your journey to connecting to your higher self, expanding your awareness, and deepening your consciousness starts here.
Welcome, welcome everyone. We are here with Dr. Dean Ornish, who I had the pleasure to meet about 15 years ago now, I think. We're here today to talk a little bit about his lifestyle program, his work, his recent book on Do It, and consciousness. So thanks for being here, Dean.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for the chance to be of service.
I'd like to give people an overview of who you are for those who are new to your work. Dr. Dean Ornish is the founder and president of the nonprofit Preventative Medicine Research Institute in Marin, as well as a clinical professor of medicine at both UCSF and UC San Diego. For over 44 years, he has directed clinical research demonstrating for the first time that lifestyle changes can reverse even severe heart disease without drugs or surgery. But it doesn't stop there. This is the cool part. The research is showing that comprehensive life changes affect gene expression, turning on disease-preventing genes and turning off the genes that promote cancer and heart disease. And he's also working on the first controlled study showing that these lifestyle changes may reverse cellular aging. And you're also the author of 7 books, all national bestsellers. And his latest book, which we just spoke about, which was co-authored by his wife, Anne, is called Undo It. And we're going to be talking a little bit about that today. Dean has also advised President Clinton, served on an advisory group for both President Obama, Governor Newsom, and countless others. And his renowned Ornish diet has been ranked number one for heart health for more than a decade, which we'll also touch upon today as well, because that diet of yours was really big when you and I first met. Actually, that's when it was really hitting the news. And he has done 3 main TED stage talks and has so many awards that it would take more than an hour for us just to go through them all. And I concur, having known you for a long time and seeing how incredible you are as a teacher, as a doctor, as a coach, and as an advisor. You're just, you've made so many profound shifts, not just in the world of medicine, but also in consciousness.
Thank you.
So let's rewind the clock just a little bit for people who are new to your work. I think we were talking about before we started recording that we met about 15 years ago, either at a TED conference or one like it. And shortly after it, the Ornish diet kind of blew up, right? Mm-hmm. And started getting recognition everywhere. And in a way, it seems like diet planted the seed for your, even the bigger work that you're doing today at PMRI. So one of the quotes that I loved in your book is the Max Planck quote, just because I love quantum physics. Science makes progress funeral by funeral. The old are never converted by new doctrines. They simply are replaced by a new generation. But this was clearly not the case with you. So was there a catalyst that really motivated you early on?
Yeah, I began doing this work 45 years ago in 1977 when I was a second year medical student at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. I grew up in Texas and I was learning how to do bypass surgery with Dr. Michael DeBakey, the pioneering doctor who actually invented bypass surgery. And we would cut people open. We bypass their clogged arteries. You tell them they were cured and they go home. And more often than not, they would do all the things that had caused the problem in the first place. You know, eat junk food, not manage stress, smoke cigarettes, not exercise. And their new bypasses would clog up. So we'd cut them open again, sometimes multiple times. And so for me, that became a metaphor of an incomplete approach, that we were literally bypassing the problem without also treating the cause. And I wondered what would happen if we treated the cause and what was the cause. And so I went to these things that people used to go to called libraries, you know, before COVID, and kind of got obsessed with learning the medical literature, the research, which showed that in dogs and cats and pigs and rabbits and monkeys, you can make them get heart disease if you fed them a typical American diet and put them under chronic stress and didn't let them exercise and made them smoke. And you could reverse it if you changed all those things. And I thought, why should people be any different? They said, no, they just are, you know? So one of the nice things about being a second year student is that you don't know enough to know what's not possible. And I remember at the time, Dr. Bakey would say, what year are you, son? I'd say, I'm starting my third year. He goes, damn, it's going to be so much harder to bust you out of here with all these weird ideas you have, you know, kind of along with that Max Planck quote. And he was very old school. He would like stick you with a needle, you know, when you're operating, if you didn't move your fingers fast enough out of the operating field and draw blood, that kind of guy. By the way, he called me about 4 years ago. I hadn't heard from him in decades, at the age of 99. And he said, hey, Dean, this is Mike DeBakey. And he had a very distinctive Louisiana accent that I recognized immediately after all these years. And I said, to what do I owe this honor? He said, well, you know those weird ideas that I used to give you such a hard time about when you were my medical student? I said, oh, yeah, I remember really well. He goes, that's what's kept me alive all these years. He says, I'm 99 years old. I'll probably be dead soon. And I just thought you'd like to know. My wife got interested in your work, and it's really helped me a lot. So if you live long, you don't necessarily have to wait for the funerals to come before people's ideas begin to change. And that's why I've spent so much of my life doing research, because that's the whole point of science, is to find out what's real and what isn't, what's true and what isn't, and for whom and under what circumstances, and so on. So I decided to take a year off between my second and third years of medical school in 1977, did a one-month study, and we found that with no control group, just 10 patients, that the patients got better. And they not only felt better, but 8 of the 10 patients were better. Their heart disease was getting better. And that was thought impossible at the time. In fact, everything we've done professionally has been thought impossible at the time. That's what makes it fun. Is people said, you know, at best you can slow down the rate at which you get worse, and that's the best you can do. And we showed that if you make bigger changes and a lot of things at the same time, that most patients got better in ways we could measure. Their chest pain went away, the blood flow to the heart improved, and so on. It was also my first experience that, pardon me, when you're doing something that really does disrupt the conventional paradigm, that it's often viewed as threatening. You know, it doesn't fit. And so it not only is disruptive in the way that you would think, because people don't believe something that's not been shown to be true before, but it threatens the order that paradigm provides, that Thomas Kuhn wrote about in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, that, you know, all paradigms are limited, but if we understand that the anomalies, the things that they don't explain, are often the most interesting things, that can be really open up entire new fields of research. But they can often be viewed as very threatening, because they threaten not only the ideas, but the order that paradigm provides, almost at a visceral level, like things coming undone. So people say, well, you know, you didn't have a randomized control group. How do you know they wouldn't have gotten better anyway? And I said, well, that's true, but how often do you see patients like this getting better anyway? Well, that's beside the point, you know. I said, okay. So went back to school, finished my MD, then took another year off. This time did a randomized control trial, only about a month long again. Replicated the earlier work. The experimental group got better. The control group got worse. We published that in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and went to Boston to do my medical residency and fellowship, moved to San Francisco, joined the faculty at UCSF, and started a nonprofit research institute, which you mentioned, the Preventive Medicine Research Institute, which is a 501c3 public foundation, which kind of gives me the best of both worlds. I can do the academic work, but I have the freedom to collaborate with anybody that I want to and raise money from anyone I want to. And so it's worked out really well. And over the next several decades, we were able to show, as you mentioned, that the most common and costly chronic diseases can often be reversed if you make big enough changes and if you change a lot of things at the same time. So the lifestyle program has been the same for all these different studies. We found that you could reverse type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, obesity. When you change your lifestyle, it changes your genes. We published a study with Craig Venter, one of the first to decode the human genome, showing that over 500 genes were changed in just 3 months. And in fact, turning on the genes that keep us healthy, turning off the genes that cause us to get sick. We did a study with Elizabeth Blackburn that I mentioned earlier, who got the Nobel Prize for discovering telomeres, the ends of our chromosomes that regulate cellular aging. They're like the plastic tips on the end of a shoelace to keep your shoelace from unraveling. They're like the plastic tips on the end of DNA that keep your DNA from unraveling. And over time, as our DNA replicates, the telomeres tend to get shorter. And as the telomeres get shorter, our lives get shorter, and the risk of premature death from a wide variety of all the diseases I mentioned, for example, go up as your risk of these diseases go up as your telomeres get shorter. And she had done, Dr. Blackburn had done some interesting studies with Alyssa Apple and others showing that chronic stress makes your telomeres get shorter faster. Women who are taking care of kids with autism, their telomeres got shorter faster. That people who are sedentary, who eat junk food, or who are under social isolation or depressed, their telomeres got shorter faster. So we met one day and I said, you know, if bad things make your telomeres shorter, maybe good things make them longer. So we did a study and we found that after just 3 months, the telomerase, the enzyme that repairs and lengthens telomeres, went up by 30%, which we published in The Lancet Oncology. And over a five-year period, we found that this was the first study showing that any intervention, including drugs, could actually lengthen telomeres. Wow. And when we published this, The Lancet editor sent out a press release calling it first study showing that lifestyle changes may reverse aging on a cellular level. And as I get older, that's more meaningful now than it might have been even 14 years ago when we published that. We are now in the midst of doing the, and by the way, Medicare, after many years, created a new benefit category to cover my reversing heart disease program, which, by the way, we did it when I finished, when I moved out to San Francisco, did the most definitive study called the Lifestyle Heart Trial. And we found, ironically, using these very high-tech, state-of-the-art scientific measures to prove how powerful these very low-tech and low-cost and often ancient interventions could be. We used quantitative arteriography to show that the arteries got less clogged after 1 year and even less clogged after 5 years, whereas the randomized control group got worse and worse. We found that using cardiac PET scans, positron emission tomography, that the blood flow to the heart improved by, in the experimental group, worsened in the control group by a factor of fourfold. And 99% of the patients stopped to reverse the progression of their heart disease by a PET scan, whereas only 5% of the randomized control group patients got worse. So we published the one-year findings in The Lancet and our five-year findings in the Journal of the AMA. And there were 2.5 times fewer cardiac events, heart attacks, strokes, bypasses, angioplasties, stents, and so on. Based on these findings, and we also began training hospitals and clinics around the country, and then Medicare, after many years of review, created a new benefit category called intensive cardiac rehab to cover my reversing heart disease program. And so that was in 2010. And so since then, my colleagues and I have been training hospitals and clinics and physician groups around the country, and it's working. We're getting bigger changes in lifestyle, better clinical outcomes, bigger cost savings, and better adherence than anyone's ever shown. We've shown that we can cut healthcare costs in half in the first year with Highmark Blue Cross Blue Shield. Mutual of Omaha found they saved almost $30,000 per patient in the first year. And based on that, Medicare created this new benefit category. And when you change reimbursement, it changes not only medical practice, but even medical education. I had thought, you know, if you just did good science, that would do it. And to some degree, it did. But if you change reimbursement, then it really, really does change things. And so we're really grateful to Medicare for doing that. And last October, a year ago, Medicare agreed to cover my reversing heart disease program when we do it by Zoom. Virtually, we've shown that it works just as well been doing by Zoom as in person. So that can really help reduce health disparities and health inequities, because before you have to live within driving distance of one of the hospitals or clinics we've trained. Now you can live anywhere. In fact, anywhere in the world, really, which is opening up a whole new world for us, which is great. And as you mentioned, we're in the midst of doing the first randomized controlled trial to see if we can stop or reverse the progression of early stage Alzheimer's disease. I think we're in a place with Alzheimer's very reminiscent of where we were, you know, 44 years ago, 45 years ago, when I started doing research with heart disease. Back then, it was thought that once you had heart disease, the best you could do would be to slow down the rate at which you got worse. We found bigger changes could stop or reverse it in most people. You know, ounce of prevention, pound of cure, if you will. And likewise, most people think that the best you can do with Alzheimer's is to slow down the rate at which you get worse. There have been, you know, 200 drug trials in the last 20 years. They spent billions and billions of dollars, and they've all failed. And there are only two drugs that have been approved. One was about a year and a half ago called aducanumab, which probably never should have been approved. One study showed it didn't do anything. The other showed it slowed it down, the rate at which it got worse a little bit. But it was like $56,000 a dose. A third of the patients got bleeding into their brains or brain swelling and so on, just to slow down the rate at which it got worse a little bit. And then just last week, a week and a half ago, another drug like that got approved It also just slows down the rate at which you get worse. And this time, you know, only 20% of people get bleeding into their brain and so on. But still, you know, that's what they say is the best you can do. Alzheimer's is very reminiscent. You know, we know what's good for your heart is good for your brain. And the Undo It book that you held up earlier puts forth this, you know, what I thought would be kind of a radical unifying theory, although it's been extremely well accepted, to my surprise, which is, why is it that these same lifestyle changes can affect the progression of the most common and costly chronic diseases? So many of them, you know, we hear so much about personalized medicine and precision medicine. And yet over these last four decades, it's been these same lifestyle changes, a whole foods, plant-based diet that's low in fat and sugar, you know, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, soy products as they come in nature, moderate exercise, you know, walking a half an hour a day and some strength training, what we call stress management techniques, which we should talk more about later when we talk about consciousness, because there's so much more than that, but stretching, breathing, meditation, and so on. And support groups, spending more time with your friends and family, you know, to reduce it. One of the quotes, the very first quote in the Undo It book is one of my favorite. It's attributed to Einstein. It says, if you can't explain it simply enough, you don't understand it well enough, you know. And so to reduce it to its essence, to eat well, move more, stress less, and love more. That's it. And the more diseases we study, the more scientific evidence we have to show how powerful these changes are and how quickly people can get better. And so I'm hopeful that we may be able to show this with Alzheimer's as well. That would be particularly meaningful if we can do that, because nothing else really can even stop it from getting worse, much less show improvement. So let's, you know, it's too early to say, but that's what we're hoping we can show. And so I love doing this work because it radically simplifies what we tell people. It's not like there's one diet for this disease, another diet for that disease. And the unifying theory just puts forth that the reason why these different diseases all respond to these same lifestyle interventions is that they're not really so different. That, you know, I was trained, you know, different diseases, different diagnoses, different treatments, but they all share the same common underlying biological mechanisms, chronic inflammation, oxidative stress, changes in the microbiome and telomeres and gene expression, angiogenesis, overstimulation of the sympathetic nervous system, and so on. And each of these mechanisms in turn is directly influenced by the lifestyle choices we make every day, what we eat, how we respond to stress, how much exercise we get, and how much love and support we have. And the more studies we do, the more evidence we have to show just how powerful they are. And because these biological mechanisms are so dynamic, how quickly you can get better or worse, depending on the lifestyle choices that you make every day.
In the research that you did, when you narrowed it down to those four, eat well, move more, stress less, love more, when you came down to those four, was it mainly the research that narrowed it down, or was some of it observation?
Narrowed it down in terms of why we chose those?
Yeah.
Well, we chose those because, you know, I had studied yoga and meditation with an ecumenical teacher named Swami Satchidananda in 1973, and found what a powerful difference it made in my own life. And so later, when I was in medical school, I realized that how much evidence there was to support each of them. But there's a synergy that comes when you change a lot of things at the same time. In science, in classical science, which is kind of limited, you know, you have one independent variable, one dependent variable, and you try to keep everything else constant. But in, you know, even when you give a drug to someone, you may be doing other things than you think you're doing. But when you do a lifestyle intervention, you're always doing things different than what you think you're doing. And so, you know, if you just did exercise only, let's say, you're not just exercising people, you're giving them a sense of control over their lives. You're often exercising with a group of other people. There's the social support. You know, when you start to exercise, you become more mindful about how food affects your ability to exercise. So, you know, you often eat healthier and so on. So I said, let's just, you know, go for a treatment effect. And we can say, taken as a whole, that these lifestyle changes cause this outcome. And there is a synergy that comes when you change a lot of things at the same time, that 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 = 10, not just 4. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why everything we've done, we're able to show for the first time, because most people didn't go far enough. It's hard to reverse a chronic disease. That's why, you know, people thought it was impossible before. They didn't make big enough changes, and they didn't make a lot of things at the same time. You know, as long as we say, taken as a whole, this intervention causes these outcomes, and the only side effects are good ones, as opposed to like bleeding in your brain, for example, I can live with that. And then hopefully that will generate more interest in other scientists to try to parse out what is the relative contribution of each of these components.
Yeah, I mean, you're really talking about whole system medicine and lifestyle as a whole, kind of looking at the whole, because if you just do one without the other, right? If you just ate well, but didn't exercise, you're not moving things through the body. So you're still going to have that inflammation, as an example.
Mm-hmm. That's true. But for me, why I love doing this work, you know, this work came out of my own pain. You know, when you're sick or you're suffering, not that we'd look for it, but sometimes there it is. That can be a powerful catalyst for transforming our lives. It can be a doorway for change, because change is hard, you know. And yet, if you're hurting badly enough, then the idea of change becomes more interesting. It's kind of like, wow, this is, you know, I'm hurting so bad, and what is this weird stuff? You know, eating a plant-based diet and meditating, and are you kidding me? But okay, loving more, really? But I'm hurting so bad, let me give this weird stuff a try. And because we've done the science, that gives many people permission to try things that they might not otherwise be willing to do. And then because these biological mechanisms are so dynamic, they often feel so much better so quickly. I mean, in the case of heart disease, most people have angina, chest pain due to heart disease. It tends to go away within the first few weeks. You know, 91% of the people become pain-free. And so for someone who can't, you know, walk across the street without getting chest pain, or make love with their spouse or lover, or play with their kids, or go back to work without chest pain within a few weeks, they can do all those things. They say, gosh, you know, I get it. I like eating junk food, but not that much, you know, because what I gain is so much more than what I give up, and how quickly that occurs. And likewise, if they get off the program, the pain often comes back. And then it's like, okay, the pain becomes the teacher and not just the enemy. It's having to be killed or bypassed or numbed, but rather, oh, this is information that I can use to make healthier choices. And fear is not really a sustainable motivator. You know, for a month or two, someone will do pretty much anything their doctor says for, you know, a month or two after they've had a heart attack, let's say. But they stop doing it, you know, because fear is not sustainable. We all know we're going to die, but we don't think about it most of the time. It's too scary. I used to get into these animated discussions with Al Gore about an inconvenient truth, you know, that it's so important. The work he's doing is so monumentally important. And yet, if you just tell people the Earth's going to melt down in 10 years, it's so scary that it really galvanizes people for a month or two, but then they just can't sustain it. It's too scary. And to talk more about the short-term things that happen, you know, and that really makes it more sustainable for people. You know, fear is not a sustainable motivator, but joy and pleasure and love and feeling that really are. And when you make big changes in lifestyle, for example, most people feel so much better so quickly, it really reframes the reason for making those changes from fear of dying to joy of living. But we're all going to die. So to me, living longer is not necessary. I mean, the whole tech world is all about, like, let's live longer, you know, let's live forever, let's cure aging, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was suicidally depressed when I was in college, when I was 19 at Rice University in Houston. And if you tell somebody who's suicidally depressed they're going to live longer, they usually will say, excuse me, you don't get it. I don't know. I'm just trying to get through the day. So many people are just trying to get through the day. You know, they'll use behaviors, you know, they'll overeat to deal with their pain, or they'll, you know, say fat coats my nerves and numbs the pain, or I've got 20 friends and this pack of cigarettes and they're always there for me and nobody else is, or we have an opioid epidemic, people trying to numb their pain, or video games, people get addicted to, you know, to try to distract themselves from their pain, or working all the time is a more socially acceptable way of doing that. And so what I'm most interested in is not how long we live, but how well we live. And this ecumenical teacher, there's a whole story around that, which we could talk about sometime, you know, really transformed my life. And what he taught me was that things like meditation, for example, are so much more, or yoga, you know, are so much more than stress management. You know, they are stress management, but they're so much more than that. You know, the ancient swamis and rabbis and priests and monks and nuns didn't develop these techniques to, you know, unclog their arteries or perform better in sports or in school or in business. I mean, they can certainly help you do all those things. But what they really are powerful tools for transformation. They can quiet down our mind and body enough to experience more of an inner sense of peace and joy and well-being, and to realize that that's really our natural state for the most part until we disturb that. That, you know, our whole culture teaches us that we get our self-worth, our sense of happiness, our sense of peace, our sense of health and well-being from outside ourselves. You know, the whole advertising industry is based on that idea. Just buy this thing, you'll be happy, you know. And what the Swami taught me was that external things can be nice, but you know, they don't bring lasting happiness, lasting meaning. You know, I learned I could take all the meaning out of life. That's why I got so depressed. Like, who cares? So what? Why bother? Nothing matters. You know, I can take all the meaning out of everything. But I later learned from him that I could imbue my life with meaning, that doing acts of service is one way to do that. It becomes the most selfish thing I can do to help someone else because it brings me a sense of meaning, you know, the universal truths that you find in all spiritual traditions, once you get past the rituals that people fight and kill each other over, you know, altruism, compassion, love, service, forgiveness, you know, those things are really what free us from that sense of suffering. And so what he said is that when you're, like, for example, at the end of a yoga class or a meditation class, you're feeling more peaceful, is to remind yourself literally that the meditation didn't bring you that sense of peace. It was there already. But rather, it helped us to stop disturbing what was there already, as opposed to bringing us something that we didn't have. Now, that may sound like, you know, parsing words and semantics, but the implications are actually very profound, because if the meditation brings that to us, then everyone who has something that we think we need, you know, has power over us. If it's there already, the question shifts from how can I get what I think I need to be happy and healthy and peaceful, to how can I stop disturbing what's already there? Not to blame myself, but to empower myself. Because if it's out there, then, you know, I'm a victim. But if it's me, then I can do something about that. And then the question shifts to something I can actually do something about. And on an even deeper level, he would say that really one of the roots of suffering and of illness is the sense of separation. Yeah. We already know that people who are lonely and depressed and isolated are 3 to 10 times more likely to get sick and die prematurely from virtually all causes, when compared to those who have a sense of love and connection and community. I wrote a book about this in 1998 called Love and Survival that reviewed what were then hundreds and now literally tens of thousands of studies that have shown that. And, you know, there's a lot of loneliness and depression in the world because of the breakdown of the social networks that used to give people that sense of love and connection and community. You know, 50 years ago, most people, you know, when I grew up in Texas, we had an extended family we saw regularly, or a neighborhood with 2 or 3 generations of people living together, or a church or synagogue or club or mosque or something that we went to regularly, or a job that felt secure that people had been at and they got to know their coworkers. And many people today don't have any of those things. And we pay a price for that. And social media doesn't really do that. In fact, one of the studies that my wife, Ann, and I, we've worked together for 26 years now, cite in the book is a study showing that the more time you spend on Facebook, the more depressed you are, because it's not an authentic intimacy.
Right.
You know, it looks like everybody has this perfect life, but you know, here we are in front of the Eiffel Tower. Here we are with our perfect life and our perfect family, you know, and yet when you grow up in an extended family or a neighborhood with 3 or 3 generations of people, they really know you. They don't just know all these nice things you said about me in my bio sketch at the beginning. They know when I was suicidally depressed or when I got busted or when I messed up or whenever, you know, and you know that they know, and they know that you know that they know, and they're still there for you. There's just something really primal about, you know, I see you fully, all of you, you know, warts and all, which many people don't have. Like, if you really knew me, you'd be out of here, you know? And so there's this sense of, like, you can't really feel fully love for who I am, but just this image of who I want you to think I am. And then if you don't get the love and respect you lose, and even if you do, you can't really enjoy it because it's like not really all of you. So in our support groups, we don't talk about diet and, you know, recipes and so on. We talk about what's really going on in people's lives so that they can get connected and talk about, you know, I might look like the perfect father, but my kid hasn't spoken to me for almost 3 years or whatever it happens to be, you know, and someone else can say, you know, I've been having problems with my kid too. And it doesn't change the problem, but it changes the shame and the guilt and the loneliness and the isolation and self-doubt and all those things that we know are so toxic to our health and our well-being. And then, you know, when you take the meditation even further, is what the Swami said, is it gives you what, you know, even to give it a name is to limit what's essentially an ineffable experience, a non-dual experience, that on one level, you know, we're separate, you know, you're you and I'm me, and we can enjoy having this dialogue. But at another level, we're all a part of something larger that connects us, whatever name you give to that, that we're, it's just, you know, you in different forms, you know, thou art that is one way to say it. I mean, he'd use the example of an old style movie theater where the light goes through from the movie projector through the movie film, and then on the screen projects all these different names and forms and dramas and so on. And you can really only enjoy the movie if you don't forget that it's a movie, you know, that we're watching the movie, but it's the same light that's illuminating all these different dramas. You know, that's one of the reasons for, I think, the resurgence in psychedelic research is that it can give people that same, properly done, that same kind of non-dual experience, which can be life transforming. It can let people let go of a lot of traumas and things that they've been carrying around for so many years. And so the idea really, if you reduce it to its essence, is that anything that brings us together is healing. You know, even the word healing comes from the root to make whole. You know, yoga is from the Sanskrit, to yoke, to unite, union. These are really old ideas that we're rediscovering. So love and compassion and service in that context are the most selfish things we can do, because it frees us from that sense of isolation and can give us that sense of connection and community and love that are so powerfully transformative. And taken even further, having that non-dual experience where you actually experience that we're never really separated. We don't really, you know, die in the sense of going into this casket, you know, in the dark room forever, you know, by yourself, but rather it's like the river returning to the source and coming back in another form. You know, that has a very different way of enjoying life. It's what's enabled me to take these huge professional risks in my career. You know, everything I've done, you know, as I mentioned, people thought was impossible, which is to me what makes it interesting. You know, it's like, well, what's the worst that can happen? If I fail, I'm going to learn something, you know? And to me, when I decided not to kill myself when I was 19, I said, if I'm going to live, I need to know what's real and what's not. And I need to know from my own experience, not borrowed from someone else, because then I can always wonder if that's true or not. So I'm going to do a lot of stupid stuff. I'm going to make a lot of mistakes. I'm going to do pretty much everything I can, as long as it's not going to hurt somebody else or permanently damage me. I'm going to try as many different things. It's going to be kind of messy and wonderful. And when I get to the end of my life, I'm not going to have a lot of regrets about, there'll be more things that I did that maybe I shouldn't have done, rather than we're wondering about things that maybe I could have done. Because if you do something and it turns out to be a bad idea, there's a lot of wisdom that comes from making mistakes and learning from them. Whereas if you just don't try, then you have the sense of regret, like I wonder what might have been. So I didn't want to end up that way.
Yeah, but think about 100 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've come a long way in 100 years. The materialists made sure, and they were dead bent on making sure that anybody who took a risk in science or medicine 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, right, their careers were jeopardized. You know, you think of David Bohm, right, who was studying under Einstein, but then when he came out with these radical ideas, suddenly he's off at some obscure university in South America because they wanted to squash all these adventurous ideas that were putting that hierarchy of control and materialism and keeping that structure at play, right? There was a lot of dissonance going on. And that happens in medicine too. So,
well, you don't have to go back 50 years. My life is a good example of that.
Yeah, your life is a great example.
I've certainly had my share of people who wanted to take me out for one reason or another. I mean, the work that I'm doing is threatening so many different
things
you think about. And that's one of the reasons I started my own institute. You know, even though I'm a full professor at the university, I'm not on salary there. You know, I don't have to, I'm on the clinical track. I was offered a tenured position and the chair of the Osher Medicine Center 20 years ago. But my friend Rachel Remen said, imagine you're swimming in the ocean and I give you the solid gold ball and say, here, you hold this. You know, I said, okay, I get it. So it's not.
Yeah, that was smart, because you wouldn't have been able to take as many risks as you have.
Well, it goes back to a book that really influenced my thinking a lot that Thomas Kuhn wrote called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he was the first to come up with this idea of a paradigm. And a paradigm is just a model of how the world works. And all paradigms are limited by definition because the world is an infinitely complex and varied place. And so no one paradigm can really encompass it all. But for 1,000 years, the Catholic Church provided that paradigm and said the earth is the center of the universe and everything revolves around it. And then in the 16th century, an Italian philosopher named Bruno came along and said, actually, I think the earth revolves around the sun. And they responded in the way that you're talking about. They burned him at the stake.
Yeah.
Then 100 years later, Galileo came along, said the same thing. And then under the threat of the Spanish Inquisition, they forced him to recant. But he had shown people how they could see for themselves with a telescope that what he said was true, that the Catholic Church was wrong, that the earth was not the center of the universe. And so the word got out, and then science became the predominant paradigm. And it's great. And that's why I'm a scientist. But as a scientist, I know that science is limited too. You know, as Dennis Burkitt once said, not everything that counts can be counted. Not everything that's meaningful is measurable. A lot of things are, though. And so the scientific method within certain limitations can be really useful in trying to sort out what's true and what isn't and for whom and under what circumstances, but it's limited. So I consciously decided when I was 19 actually more like when I was 21, when I read that book, that I was going to try to see the world through as many different paradigms as I could, recognizing they're all limited. And, you know, as I mentioned before, it's the anomalies when something comes up that doesn't fit within the paradigm that are, to me, the most interesting. And yet those are the ones that are most threatening because they threaten the order that that paradigm provides. It's like kind of like if you've been a San Francisco earthquake and the ground starts to shake. It's like you've got nothing to hold on to. You know, it's like something so primal as the ground. Like, where is it safe? You know, it's like it doesn't feel safe anymore if these ideas make the paradigm seem like it's not explaining everything.
Except that the things that you brought up, psychedelics, ayahuasca journeys, frog medicine, all of these things are emerging now because I think, you know, what you're talking about, you've been a meditator for years, right? But not everyone started that way. So imagine, right, you're a tech executive who thinks that's a little too woo-woo. So they dive in, they have this ayahuasca journey, and they're like, wow, I had an outer body experience. Or what was that bliss? What was that feeling of oneness that I had? Wow, I want more of it. And so
well, that's the point. That's the point, is that you have different paths of having these that are outside the conventional paradigm. You know, when Ram Dass, you know, Richard Alpert was a Harvard professor and got into psychedelics, they fired him. You know, that may not necessarily happen today. Now they have, at Hopkins, they have a whole division, you know, with the MAPS program looking at studying psychedelics. We've come a long way since then.
Yeah, and so Michael Pollan, I don't know if you heard about that, but Michael Pollan started something at Berkeley.
Yeah, no, Michael's a friend. So yeah, we talked about that. And so the point is that initially it's disruptive, but over time, truth is truth and ultimately sustainable. And so the more paradigms I can see the world through, it's like the blind man and the elephant, the more pixels in a picture, the greater can be the understanding.
So let's move a little bit into one of my, it's not a recent curiosity because HeartMath's been around for a long time now. And most people in this world who are bridging the worlds of science and spirituality know about heart coherence. But what I'm curious about is the studies that people like Bruce Lipton have done and Dr. Joe Dispenza, where they're getting people into this heart coherence through meditation, through quieting the mind, getting into an alpha or a theta, right? A theta brainwave state. And then they're seeing that correlation in their auric field, right? That it's not so murky anymore. And this auric field, the energy field, is connected to the physical body. So I'm curious about what your research or observation or experience or combination, all three, has seen with when people are getting into that heart coherence. Have you done any studies with that to see how that's related to reversing disease?
Only anecdotal and personal experiences, anecdotal observations and personal experiences, that coherence is order. You know, a laser is coherent light. It's focused light. Anytime you have order, you have healing and you have power. You know, the light in a light bulb is all different frequencies. A laser is just the same. It's the same frequency and all the waves are in steps. You can burn through steel. You can bounce it off the moon. And when you meditate, your brain becomes more ordered, more coherent. You can form new synaptic connections. You know, in Alzheimer's, in early Alzheimer's, the brain cells are not usually very few of them are not dead. They just lose their connection with each other. So anything that connects us is healing. You know, the word healing comes from the root to make whole. You know, yoga is from the Sanskrit to yoke, to unite, union. These are really, again, old ideas that we're rediscovering. So anything that helps us to bring us together and form a more coherent relationship with someone else, anything that helps us become more coherent in our own mind, in our own brain, in our own heart, in our own body, helps to promote healing.
So what about the connection to neurogenesis? I thought that section in your book was fascinating. The concept that your brain can grow new brain neurons in just a few weeks. So meditation helps that, right?
Well, meditation increases neurogenesis. Exercise increases neurogenesis. You can grow so many new brain cells in 3 months that your brain can get measurably bigger. That was thought impossible when I was a medical student. We were taught you had a certain number of brain cells, and if you went out and had a six-pack and killed off a few thousand of them, you never got them back. Your brain is continually regenerating them, but not just the number of cells, but also the connections that they have with each other, which is in some ways even more important.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Nobel Prize a few days ago went to, in physics, to the guy who discovered mirror neurons. And mirror neurons, I think, are especially interesting because they're wherever they are, irrespective of how far apart they are, they resonate with each other. And what affects one affects the other instantly. And I think our souls are like that in a way. We're all mirror neurons for each other in many ways.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying actually echoes what all the ancient sages, mages, and teachers across time and across cultures have taught, just using different language.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The irony, of course, is that many religions focus on the isolation. We are the one path to God, you know, right. And we're going to kill you if you don't let us love you enough. You know, I mean, and Aldous Huxley wrote a wonderful book called The Perennial Philosophy.
Yes, so, love it. You know,
what are the common themes across all these different religions? And it, as I mentioned earlier, love and compassion and altruism and it's not, again, for some external reward. It's not to get to go to good karma or go to heaven or get a gold star. It's that this is what frees us from our suffering right here and right now. The one emotion, for example, that's continually linked with, in all studies, with heart disease is chronic anger and humiliation, which is a facet of that. It's not talking fast or multitasking, fortunately, for people like me. It's, you know, chronic anger. If you're carrying a lot of chronic, one study looked at over a million, or like it was 140 million Twitter feeds, and those that had the most anger and isolation, those people were much higher risk of getting a heart attack than even those who smoked or who were diabetic or had high blood pressure or the usual or ate unhealthy foods. These are powerful factors. And so when I forgive somebody to try to let go of that anger, it doesn't condone or excuse what they've done. But what it does is it frees me from the effects of the anger. It's like that old thing, when I point my finger at someone, there are three fingers pointing back at me. If I hate you, it harms me. You know, when Nelson Mandela was freed from prison after 16 years and did his long walk to freedom, he said, he was asked, do you hate your jailers? He said, well, you know, they took away the best years of my life, but if I hate them, I'm still in prison in my heart. You know, so these are themes that come up over and over again, because truth is truth. We keep rediscovering the same things. And so what I try to teach people is that anything that we can do to take us out of that sense of being separate and only separate, whether it's through service or psychedelics or study or whatever it is, love and compassion and altruism and forgiveness are four of the most powerful ways that you find in all cultures and all religion. And the other thing is that, as I mentioned before, if I choose, just the act of choosing not to do or eat certain foods can imbue those choices with meaning.
Yeah.
You know, if I, you know, all spiritual paths have their dietary guidelines, and sometimes they're in conflict with each other. On this one, you can eat this, but not that, or certain days of the week, or certain times of year, or whatever. But I think that what really matters is whatever the intrinsic benefit is of eating or not eating certain foods, just the act of choosing not to do something imbues those choices with meaning. So is this like, if I'm going to be in a monogamous relationship, is that the ball and chain? Well, it can be. Or is it an opportunity to create something truly sacred, you know, that sacred, not in the sense of boring, you know, kind of like moldy and, you know, old, but sacred in the sense of the most special, the most erotic, the most pleasurable, the most joyful, the most meaningful, you know. And so much of our culture teaches us, like, the more people you can be in relationships with, the happier you are. And that was one of the things I tried too, you know, like with everything else I tried, because I needed to find out for myself. And I learned, well, yeah, it's fun, but it's not nearly as fun as being in a committed monogamous relationship like I'm in now, where everything we do has that sense of meaning and joy. And rather than having the same kind of superficial relationship with different people, I find that we can have the most amazing experiences, you know, on all levels, because the more intimate it is, the more erotic it is. That's something I never knew before. And you can only be intimate to the degree that you can be emotionally vulnerable. You can open your heart to someone. You can only do that to the degree you feel safe, because, you know, we've all opened our hearts and gotten hurt. So it's like, the heart goes, be careful, you know, but, and it's not like binary. It's not like you're safe or not safe. We've been together, as I mentioned, we've worked together for 26 years. We've been married for 17, and we still are hitting new levels of intimacy. You know, it's an infinitely rich, you know, it's like the infinite layers of an onion, let's say. And the more we can love and trust each other, which again is not binary, the more intimate we can become, the more we have the most amazing experiences that I've never even read about, much less or imagined, much less experienced. And so if people really understand, or if you choose not to eat certain foods, you know, you're imbuing those choices with meaning, which makes them sustainable. It's meaningful if it's sustainable. If it's pleasurable, it's sustainable.
the power of intention. So that's something we haven't talked about, but you do talk about guided imagery, both direct and indirect in your book. And then you also talk about the importance of meditating on word, right? And that power of language. Our mutual friend, Tony Robbins, right? Talks a lot about that, that power of language and how, I don't think he uses this word, but a lot of people now do. They'll talk about language has frequencies and frequencies have power and they shift our consciousness. Yeah, because you had some really great things in the book about really bringing people through this guided imagery to kind of open people up to that expansiveness, right?
What I'm most interested in is how you can use guided imagery to get in touch with your own inner wisdom, with that inner guru, that inner Swami, that inner God, that inner knowing, whatever name you give to that, which we all have. It's that still small voice within that speaks very clearly, but very quietly, that gets drowned out by the chatter of everyday life. And I've learned that at the end of a meditation, when my mind is relatively more quiet, I can access that information. I mentioned earlier that everything we've done has been thought impossible, but really the inspiration for doing those things came from listening to that little voice within and saying, this can work. And then I'll go to the library and read up and kind of reverse engineer to see, like, why might this work? And, oh, I get it. This can do that, and this mechanism affects this, and so on. But I've learned to trust that inner voice. We all have that. And it's so easily drowned out by, as I mentioned, the chatter of everyday life, just all the stuff we're doing. And so I've learned at the end of a meditation, I'll say hello, and it'll say hello, and I've learned to recognize it. And I'll say, I always ask the same question to start. To what am I not paying attention? What am I not paying attention to that I need to pay attention to? And then just listen, and it will tell me. And then that'll generate another series of questions and so on. We'll have this little dialogue. We all have that. And that sense of imagery to me is among the most powerful that I found in being also the most practical.
Do you think that's our higher self that we're connecting to? I mean, you call it the still voice within, God, inner wisdom, whatever language we want to use for it. But what is it for you?
Higher self is just another name for that. It's all of that.
Yeah. But do you feel like when you're going to that place, you're connecting to your higher self, but do you also feel like you have the ability to connect to the all?
Well, you already are connected to the all. It's not like you have to connect to the all. We are already. When people use the term that they are a realized person, it doesn't mean they got that. It means they realized that it was already there. That's who they are. That's who we already are. You know, it's that double vision to see both the duality and the oneness. That you realize is already there. It's not something you have to get outside yourself. It's already there.
So it's the inner knowing. It's not the, because, you know, I think a lot of times, like you mentioned earlier, religion, traditional religion anyway, had us always focus outside for the answer. So it's really going inward and listening for that inner knowing that just is. It's not something you're looking for. It's already there. It's just being quiet enough to hear that voice speak.
Yeah, again, all religions, when you get down to the essence of it, you know, in Judaism, Shema Yisrael, the Lord is one, Adonai Echad, not one guy sitting on a throne and a white, long white beard up in the sky. We are all one in that sense. Yeah. You find this in all, if not the, you know, the ones that in the Orthodox religions, and certainly the esoteric traditions of all these different religions come to that same place. Again, it's not something you have to get. It's something that you realize, you're enlightened, you are aware of what you have already. It's right there already. It's like Swami Vivekananda, who 150 years ago brought yoga to this country. He said, you cover your eyes and cry out that you're blind. You know, it's already there.
So do you have any parting words for people who are listening about really combining everything that we've talked about today?
I mentioned earlier the study that Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn and Alyssa Epple did on women who were taking care of kids with autism, mm-hmm. and found their telomeres were much shorter than women who didn't have that because of the chronic stress, the overstimulation of their sympathetic nervous system, if you will. But not all the women had that. You know, some women did just fine. Their telomeres were just as long as the women who didn't have kids with autism because they were doing the kinds of things we've been talking about. They were eating well, they were moving more, they were stressing less, they were loving more. You can buffer. The stress comes not just from what you do, but how you react to what you do. How you react in turn is often a function of what you're doing. but also how you view the world and your perception. And again, if you view yourself as being separate and only separate, and you have to get all this stuff to be happy and healthy, then you're going to be chronically stressed. If you feel like you're more inwardly defined, you know, my teacher used to say, we're fine and we're born fine and then we define ourselves.
And get stuck That's good.
We get stuck in all these definitions of who we think we are, separate from everyone else. But if we can go back to that place, then we don't need so much out there. It's like, oh, I used to think if only I had more or whatever, then I'd be happy. And until you get it, you're not happy. If someone else gets it, then you're really not happy. And even if you get it, it's great for a little while, but it's not, it doesn't really fill that hole. It's usually either now what, it's never enough, or so what, big deal. It doesn't provide that lasting sense of meaning. And so the cycle continues. But if you are more inwardly defined, if you experience that sense of non-dual state, of that sense of inner peace and well-being, then you go out in the world and accomplish even more without getting stressed in the process. You know, there's an old proverb, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. You know, you do the same thing, but your intention behind that is very different. So I'm so appreciative of the chance to have this dialogue with you today. And I hope at least part of it's been useful for the people who hear this. If they want to learn more about our work, just go to ornish.com and it's all free. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much, Dean. It's always a pleasure to spend time with you. And on the subsequent pages, we will be posting links to your organization, the Institute, where people can find your books, and of course, learn more about you.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks so much. You've been listening to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. You can learn more about our work at bluesoulearth.com, studywithspirit.com, and bluesoulmedia.com.
Also, head over to bluesoulsummit.com, where you can watch video interviews, each season tackling a particular topic. We are also at Blue Soul Earth on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Clubhouse.
Join us for a future episode of Blue Soul Chats, where we hope to ignite your soul's journey, expand your awareness, and deepen your consciousness.
Thanks for being here, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and listen to previous episodes in our library.